Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. President Joe Biden issued the first ever proclamation for Indigenous Peoples Day, federally recognizing a day long known as Columbus Day, following a growing number of states and cities throughout the country over the years. But the president also issued a separate proclamation for Columbus Day, recognizing the country's Italian heritage that began more than 500 years ago when Italian explorer Christopher Columbus launched the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria off the coast of Spain in 1492. Now, this first ever formal juxtaposition really captures an important truth, that our country's formation is bound to a painful history of atrocities and devastation inflicted on Native American and Indigenous communities who called the Americas home for centuries before Columbus ever set foot. And today, some 529 years later, many would argue righting the wrongs of the past is just impossible. But progress is taking place. Today, we're going to commemorate this moment by listening to the issues and celebrating Indigenous communities throughout our area. Joining us first is Jesus Tarango, chairman of Wilton Rancheria, the tribe called Sacramento County home in the city of Elk Grove. Chairman Tarango, welcome to Insight.
Kuchikalupa, Yasser, Jesus Tarango. Good morning.
Good morning. Before we share Wilton Rancheria's really difficult history with the federal government, what is the significance of Indigenous Peoples Day to you?
And I'm glad you asked that, because it's obviously going to be different for all of us as we all see things different through the optics. For me, Indigenous Peoples Day is a beautiful thing. Because it allows us Indigenous people a chance to renew our obligations to your past, our present, and our future. I think it's a day where we are finally able to celebrate the ancestors that we know we come from, but also give the people of this great nation a chance to understand who we are. And I think that's what, for me, the real movement of Indigenous People Day is, to educate the people. Indigenous people, we know our history, and I think we celebrate it 365 days a year. But I think, for us to mark this day as Indigenous People's Day, I think it's, for me, it's a chance now for America and the communities that we live in to educate themselves as to who we are.
You are a young chairman, 41 years old, and you grew up with this culture. Would you mind just sharing with us some of your family history?
Sure. I come from, I'm the great-great-great-great-grandson of Alec Blue, the great-great-great-grandson of Annie McKean. I'm the great-grandson of Irene. I'm the grandson of Alvin Daniels. And obviously, I'm the son of Mary Tarango, who's an honored elder here. My mother was one of the main people, I would say, who led to Wilton's re-recognition back in the 80s and 90s. So I've always had at least the politics part and the leadership, always seeing my mom out there, being a leader for her people and fighting, for our rights. So in that aspect, I've always grew up in that. For us here in Wilton, not a lot of our people were blessed to be able to understand their culture and their traditions and to learn the songs and our dances. And we were fortunate. My uncle, Bill Franklin, had a dance group that he had going on in the 40s and 50s and carried on all the way until he couldn't anymore. And so we grew up dancing and singing our traditional songs and dances, and obviously too, playing hand game. It's a traditional game that we play here. So definitely, for me, not a normal upbringing, I would say, unfortunately for us here that are border, maybe a city, a little bit more urban, not so much in the rural area. And again, in California, we're all different. From the north, the south, to the central, we all have different stories. But here, was definitely blessed to be able to grow up in my culture.
Well, Wilton Rancheria was initially federally recognized back in the 1920s, and then that designation was abruptly pulled in 1959. And your tribe really spent decades, as you were just talking about, regaining your rights, becoming re-recognized in 2009. I mean, you lived through such a complicated history with the federal government. How do you reflect on that?
I think you go to your old ones. For me, I didn't grow up in that era. And our history's there, your stories are there. And even for our youth, We got to get back to listening to your elders and making the time for them, you know. But even in listening to the old ones and some of the struggles that they had, it really wasn't extravagant things that they were wanting. You know, we're talking about simple living conditions, you know, and education for their children. And some of the things that, you know, even in one of the videos that we did, you know, for our project that's being built across the way there, you know, the elders that spoke in there just said they just wanted the simple things in life, and the fact that they couldn't have those. You know, that's where I think for us or for me, you know, that pain, you know, you feel that pain of imagining being a young child and, you know, going to school and maybe being picked on because your clothes weren't right, or you were from Wilton, you're a dirty Indian, you know, and people would spit on you and things like that. And so it's a beautiful day. Like I said, like even today for us, you know, we have to remind ourselves of those things and make sure our youth hears those things. Because what my people were wanting, you know, I wouldn't say was extravagant or much. You know, I think we should all have that, especially when we're the original inhabitants of this land.
Yeah. Especially having to fight for re-recognition. How did this shape or challenge Wilton Rancheria retaining its culture? I mean, you even mentioned that Wilton Rancheria is within an urban area as opposed to a rural area.
Correct. Yeah. And again, you know, every tribe here in California is different. You know, you have some tribes who still have reservations, or even for their rancherias was a little bit more intact. So I think, you know, if you think about California, you really have to think about the time frames of things. And when you talk about our culture, you know, it was already hard for us to even practice our religion and our culture. And being in the city, you know, one of our last villages, you know, was still intact in the early 1900s. But even for them, I can't imagine what it would have been like to try to carry your traditions on. So for us, you know, it's really that we are trying to just teach it, right? We have to go back and teach it. And I think that's where, you know, you see our re-recognition is that's a renewal for us as well, you know, where we're able to have the federal help, you know, to give us the funding that we need to create a cultural space. You know, we definitely have the land around us, but it takes money to buy it. And, you know, so for us, bringing our culture back is the main thing. That's got to be the main thing for Indigenous people. You got to know where you come from and who you are.
You officially adopted a constitution in 2012. That was less than a decade ago. I mean, this is a young tribal government. What are the biggest issues facing Wilton Rancheria?
You know, for us, I would say right now it's just being patient. You know, I think it's being patient. For people who know about our history, you know, our tribal members, you know, they see us as we should have been there with Grayton and UAIC in 2000, you know, but time is on our hands, I would say, and time is everything. And so for us, we just have to be patient and believe in the process, and also your ancestors, right? I think they still speak to us. And that's why you see, I think, the movements that you have today. You know, but for us, I think it's really just the people coming together under one flag and us really putting our differences aside. You have a lot of generational, I would say, genocide, you know, where you have, you know, family histories in Indian country. It's a little tough, you know, and so for us, we have to be the bigger people and humble ourselves sometimes with our own tribal members and say, let's all do this for the right reason. And that right reason's for the community. You know, I think that's really any tribal nation or government or people, I think that's really we're our own enemies, right? And so for us, we really have to be able to say, why are we here? And it's for the community. We all come from a community. You know, even for me, I share with my family members, you know, we talk about loyalty, who you should be loyal to, and not loyal to my immediate family. I'm loyal to my blood and my bloodline, and that's my people. And so I think for us as Indian communities, we that's all of our biggest opportunity is fighting amongst ourselves and being able to say what you know may be right or what I may, you know, what I heard or how I was taught is this way and how I taught was that way. We got to put that to the side and just figure out what we're going to do and move forward.
Yeah, after I've been following this for years, after years of renderings and negotiations and development, your tribe, Wilton Rancheria's Sky River Casino, broke ground earlier this year. I mean, that's a big moment. Can you just remind us of the benefits gaming has on your tribal community, as well as the surrounding county and city?
Yeah, well, I can't speak too much on what it has an immediate impact for the tribal members yet. We don't have that.
And, right.
You know, that's one of those things too. You know, I wish the society would understand that, you know, tribes just don't put a casino up and they become rich instantly and they just spend their money extravagantly. You know, that comes with a big piece of debt there, you know, and for us, I think that we definitely will see the benefits. But, you know, I come up from an upbringing of seven generations. And so the things that we're doing today, it's not for me. It's not for my kids. It's for my kids' kids. And then the next three or four generations down the road. But when you see some of these bigger tribal nations that have been able to benefit from gaming and the beautiful things that they are doing, that's what I'm hopeful for. You know, San Manuel does a beautiful thing down there, you know, where you talk about being able to send your youth to any college or any university that they may want. That's power. You know, it's not the new car that I have sitting in my driveway. It's educating our people so that when we're gone, it's going to continue to go. You know, and then obviously the benefits of the city, you know, we share, we have MOUs with the County of Sacramento and the City of Elk Grove. So obviously, you know, in a number standpoint, $186 million is a lot of money to the City of Elk Grove over the next 20 years, that obviously will be able to help them in the different ways that they may need. You know, you talk about the traffic, you know, protection, the fire, all those different things, you know, we're able to do by allowing us to have this project across the street there. So I think the city and the county will definitely benefit. But I think for us, you know, we're the only tribal nation here in the Sacramento County. It's big. It's big. I think when you talk about representation, which I'm a big fan of, I think our Indian people need representation. And, you know, us being the capital tribe, you know, I think it's going to be beneficial, you know, for the state as well.
Last question. Last month, Governor Newsom signed into law a bill that will remove the Junipero Serra statue that's off Capitol grounds, replace it, the Spanish missionary, with a Native American monument. You and I chatted about this a little bit last week. What does this mean to you? What significance does this have?
You know, I had to take a pause there because, you know, when you really talk about the significance, it's more of a, it's like a feeling. You know, it's a beautiful feeling. It's a sad feeling as well, though, to think that, you know, so many people, you know, had to go there and see that and be told false stories about what this great man did. You know, but for me, it's really a start, I would say, to something, you know, and I hope, you know, for me, in my terms here with my people, you know, I'm going to strive to fight for representation for our people. I think our youth deserve the same heroes, and our youth deserve to know where they come from, that they come from greatness. And having the ability to keep a statue like him down is the start. It's a start. I think the real work is what we have to do next. And that's for the six sponsoring tribes to come together and really have a conversation about what we want to show the people that come to our capital, who the original inhabitants were. You know, and then from there, you could carry it on a little bit farther. And I think that's where the education piece comes in. But it's a beautiful day. It was a beautiful day when that thing got signed. And, you know, I remember a year ago when we started that fight, didn't know we'd be here a year later and be so successful. You know, I definitely know a part of me wants to go to D.C. and ask them to remove the Serra statue from D.C. But I think for us, we have some homework that we have to do on our end. Obviously, to remove them from there, we'd have to replace them. You know, so, you know, Tilly Hardwick, you know, may be somebody that we could put there. But definitely it's a start definitely a proud moment for us here in California.
Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
And that is Jesus Tarongo, the chairman of Wilton Rancheria, the tribe called Sacramento County home in the city of Elk Grove. Up next, there are more than 100 federally recognized tribes in California, but dozens of others are still fighting for that right. We're going to get a better understanding of the legal road and the benefits. We'll also explore an important indigenous designation within the LGBTQ+ community known as Two-Spirit. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Comfort you. Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Native American tribes are often viewed as merely cultural entities, as opposed to actual governments. This rings even more true for tribes that are not federally recognized. As we just heard, the process for a tribe to become federally recognized can be a difficult process. The lack of understanding has skewed how laws surrounding indigenous people and tribes are written, viewing Native Americans and tribes as a race instead of a sovereign government. Here to help us better understand the recognition process and the rights that tribes have is Heather Hostler. She's the executive director for California Indian Legal Services. Heather, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. I appreciate you inviting me to talk with you today.
You know, Heather, you're new to the position. You've worked with the state government and tribal governments to really strengthen communication between them. Under your direction, what are the priorities of the California Indian Legal Services?
Okay, wonderful. So I'm just 1 month on the job, so I think I'm still in the honeymoon phase of getting to really know the job, but also have all of the big ideas and dream big. So I'm glad to be in that space. I am a member of the Hoopa Valley tribe, and I just wanted to acknowledge them calling in from the Nisenan Maidu traditional lands. And so appreciate being able to do that today. So for our priorities, we're really thinking about a capital presence. Sacramento has moved the principal office, California Indian Legal Services has moved the principal office to Sacramento. So we are able to have direct connection to our legislators, to our executive branch partners, and to other organizations doing great work. So we're really looking at how can we do better upstream when laws are made? Where can we make the most impact in that space? And then when it gets into the executive branch, when they're developing regulations, how do we think about them doing that right so that they're considering tribes as governments, not just in a racial classification? We're also looking at forging dynamic partnerships. So understanding there's some really fantastic people in leadership at tribal organizations doing really great work. And how do we do this work in partnership? I also just wanted to highlight Chairman Tarango and his fantastic leadership. He's a great partner, a dynamic leader, and really looking forward to partnering with Wilton Rancheria as we move forward in this new phase at California Indian Legal Services.
Yeah, I mean, and Chairman Tarango really hit home the difficult process of becoming federally recognized, and they actually had it stripped away and they had to get re-recognized. What are the differences between the relationships of federally recognized tribes with the government and tribes that don't have that recognition?
You know, it's really important thing for tribes who want to be recognized because it is a legal political distinction for federally recognized tribes. So they have a legal classification that provides for a government-to-government relationship. In California in particular, there isn't a recognition process at the state level. So non-federally recognized tribes are always advocating and for their positions in a space that is not on equal footing as a sovereign nation. There is state law that provides for cultural resources protection, There are state laws that are, some could argue, are de facto recognition. But when it comes to actual sovereign status in the eyes of the federal government, they don't enjoy that relationship, which is really a burden for them. And they're constantly in an uphill battle is what it feels like.
Yeah, and I think given that you just said that, you know, state recognition doesn't exist, with that, what are some of the shortfalls that you see when it comes to state governments working alongside tribes?
So state recognition, just as a point, is a process in other states. We don't particularly have that in California. My previous roles have been gubernatorial appointees to work on better government-to-government relationships with tribes and with the state government. I was raised by a tribal leader. My father was elected to our tribal council, and all throughout my upbringing and adolescence, I remember him really fighting for rights, and I remember how hard it was for him to work with the state, and it was constantly a disrespectful situation, as was what I can recall. But now I think there is a willingness, there is a distinct shift, I think, from the Brown administration and, of course, with the Newsom administration to get it right. Where I see that there is a huge challenge is the lack of education. When I was working with the state, I worked with really intelligent, driven folks who want to do the right thing, but they didn't know the history of tribes accurately. They didn't understand the legal political status of federally recognized tribes. And they were always trying to incorporate it in a way that didn't necessarily afford for access. And so what that created is a tumultuous situation at times, or they didn't know how to incorporate tribes. So tribes were left still on the outside, not able to really enjoy the what was planned as part of any sort of initiatives.
You mentioned that other states offer recognition. Why does California not do so?
You know, it's an interesting question. And when I worked under the Brown administration, I was the chief deputy tribal advisor. And this question came up from time to time. So a lot of non-federally recognized tribes and, you know, of course, federally recognized tribes talk about inherent sovereignty. So it is not in the United States government's gift to say if you're sovereign as a tribe or not. There was a quote from the National Congress of American Indians today for Indigenous Peoples Day that said, "We were a people before we the people." So that a lot of times is the state in the position to say who is a tribe and who is not. I don't know the answer to that. I think that would have to be taken on by the governor's office to acknowledge if they want to go through that process. Because once you start down a recognition process, there is a full change in how we do business that really needs to follow. It can't happen only in name. It has to actually come through our systems, our laws, our regulations. And so that certainly will have to be a major direction change by either the legislature or the governor's office.
How many tribes would you estimate don't have federal recognition here in California? I believe it's dozens.
Yeah, so it's anywhere from 40 to, I would say, 55. There are some tribes that are pending right now. They've applied. So they've submitted their application through the federal recognition process. But there's also some tribes who are fully functioning, operating. They don't have their federal recognition, and they don't plan to apply for federal recognition status. And so roughly, I would say the number that I listed is probably what is still pending for applications through the federal government.
Finally, you just relocated to Sacramento. This is also a new chapter for your organization. What are some of the other big issues that you want to tackle? You know, some of the big reasons that tribes or individuals seek out help from California Indian Legal Services.
So California Indian Legal Services is a legal aid for issues of federal Indian law. So oftentimes, so tribes have citizens or members, and those citizens or members will certainly have the general issues that you will find at a legal aid that may have to do with, you know, disability rights or other things. But we're looking particularly at issues of federal Indian law. So I won't go into the details, but there are wills, Indian wills that need to be specific, because whether there's land holdings or other nuances, that needs to have a specific review. So we hear about that a lot. We also hear about expungement, and that's a big issue. So if we think about a lot of the justice issues that are out there and a lot of disproportionality, a lot, you'll see Native American, African American are usually at the top of those statistics. And so we'll have our people who are coming in doing high level functioning jobs, but still have some expungement issues that have not been resolved. From tribes, we often hear about ordinances. You noted that Chairman Tarango and Wilton Rancheria have a constitution. Well, the constitution is part of the tribal law. And so in order to carry that out, there's legal writings that need to happen. So we're hearing a lot about that from tribes, but also tribes who really just want to be a force in California. They want to make sure that there's statewide impact, there's benefit, there's a lot of work to do. So we're hearing from tribes, let's do some education for the folks who make the laws, but let's also do a lot of work on righting the wrongs that have been held up through systems and laws for since the inception of this state.
Heather, welcome to Sacramento, and thanks for spending time with us.
Certainly. Thanks for having me.
Heather Hostler is the Executive Director for California Indian Legal Services. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're now going to spend some time learning about an important Indigenous designation within the LGBTQ plus community. Two-Spirit, broadly speaking, defines a tribal member considered neither man nor woman, but combines activities of both men and women and occupy a distinct alternative gender status. And I really say broadly speaking because, as we're about to learn, Two-Spirit is far from a monolith within tribal communities. Carl Colgrove is a member of the Hoopa Valley Tribe, as well as Heather, who we just heard from, and he is the first Native American board member with the Sacramento LGBT Community Center. Carl joins us with more on his journey and what Two-Spirit means to him. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you, Vicki. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, wonderful to have you. The Hoopa Valley Tribe is located in Humboldt County, and you have such an interesting perspective and experience. Would you mind sharing that a little bit?
Sure. So my entire family is from Hoopa, back up in the mountains. I come from two large families, two of the largest families in Hoopa. And I have countless relations, cousins, aunties, and uncles. When I was born, my parents followed the lumber industry up to Oregon. So I spent the first part of my youth living in Oregon in a very small lumber community. And it wasn't until later on when that industry took a turn for the worse that my parents ended up moving back to the reservation and we lived with family. So I feel really fortunate to have kind of walked in both spaces and seen two different perspectives of what it means to be an Indigenous person in the world today.
You know, having grown up in Oregon and moving to the reservation from, you said, 15 to 26 when we chatted, so about nearly a decade, how did this shape the way you see the world?
I think that I can share, when I was younger, I grew up in a very dominantly white community, and I was bullied all through grade school and in middle school. And there were two things that set me apart from everybody else. One was the color of my skin. I was very brown, and I was probably one of the only brown kids in my school district. And there was all kinds of terms thrown my way. And the other was I was a very effeminate young boy. And so I always got teased because of that. And so growing up, you know, I always just wanted to be like everybody else. I hated the color of my skin. I wanted to be white so bad. I wanted to just fit in with everybody else. And I knew that when I had this fear of when we were to go back to the reservation, I thought, oh my gosh, if I'm being bullied now because of this, because of the color of my skin, because who I am and how I present myself, I can't imagine how much I'll be bullied and how much worse it's going to be for me on the reservation, because we're taught that our communities are so rough and hard knock. And but when I got to the res, it was not the case. It was actually totally the opposite. I was welcomed, and so it really kind of changed my skew about Native communities, and I learned a lot of important things about who we are as Indigenous people and what is really important to us. So I hope that provides a little insight.
It certainly does. When did you come to learn about Two-Spirit and what it means?
Sure. It wasn't until fairly recently, I would say probably within the last 6 years, that I really started hearing the term Two-Spirit being thrown around. And I currently work for the Sacramento Native American Health Center. And in this space, we've brought some presenters through at times to present these ideas and talk about it. And so as I understand and have been taught over the last 6 years, that the Two-Spirit is really a contemporary term used by Native Indigenous folks with traditional and cultural understandings of gender roles and identity. So the term, as I've been told, comes from the Anishinaabe language, meaning they both have a male spirit and a female spirit in the same body. And so looking back traditionally, before contact, before Columbus, before the gold rush, all these different things that have happened on Native land, Indigenous Two-Spirit people were male, female, intersexed individuals among many other genders across all these different nations who could move between various roles assigned to quote unquote gender within their communities. And in many cases, these folks were regarded and very highly regarded and held very sacred roles within their communities and different duties.
How does Two-Spirit resonate with you?
For me, I had to really think about it. The goal of Two-Spirit, as I understood it, it could be used as two things, not so much a designation as it is. A, it's a collective organizing tool to kind of call out all of these, I guess, queer Indigenous folks from different communities that have these diverse sexualities, genders, and gender expressions, to kind of gather and start the conversation of who are we as queer Indigenous folks and what were our sacred roles. And it really directs you to go back to your communities and ask those questions of your own communities, because there's 574 tribes in the United States, 100 of them, 109 in California alone. And so over all of these different nations and communities, Two-Spirit really has its own unique meaning for each one of these individuals' communities. And so the real movement of the Two-Spirit theory is to not just stop at identifying as Two-Spirit being, because it's certainly not just an LGBTQ Indigenous person. It embodies so much more. And so when I was thinking about, well, what does that term mean to me? I reached out to my cousin and I said, you know, I'm hearing this term a lot and I really want to know, like, what is Hoopa? What do our people say about that? And what are our words? I know there's over 130 terms across all these different communities for what a Two-Spirit person is in their own language. And I wanted to know what ours was. And so through the chain of cousins, I got this really important lesson that came back to me. And what was explained to me that in the Hoopa language, we didn't have terms for Two-Spirit people. We didn't even have terms for man, woman. We classified our folks by age group. So you were either an adult person, you're a young person, or you're an elder or a non-human being. And amongst those, it wasn't so much like who you were or how we referred to you. It was more like what you did in your communities. And so as a two-spirit person in today's society, if I were to go home, you know, I always thought, you know, growing up, I always knew, like, I was always teased. You're so effeminate, you're so effeminate. And so in the language, in the traditional language, the closest word for woman would be to, the translation means the one that ties on the dress. And so they might say of an effeminate man that they're somesilon, which means to tie on the dress. And so a man who may present a little effeminately would be somesilon adone, which would be he may present or act or prefer to do like the things that women do. And then even a step further, so if a person were to train themselves to become a woman, I think if we were to equate that today to transition, they would say that they were somislan adultue, which means to train to become a woman. And that person would live their life as a woman in community. And then alternatively, there's other terms too for, there's hoestai adone, which would be more of a masculine woman assigned at birth. And then hoestai adultue, which would be a woman who's training to be a man and live their life as a man in society. And so hearing that, you know, at first I was a little bummed because, you know, I hear all of these wonderful stories and all these other cultures across the United States where these two-spirit folks are really highly revered and they're matchmakers and they're medicine people and they have these really special places in their communities. And the idea is to really go back to those and be recognized among your communities. But for me, it really held a special lesson because growing up, I had always just wanted to be like everybody else. And so for me, hearing that lesson really drove that message home that, you know, back home, even though I am different inside and I always felt different, the lesson was really like, you're no different from anybody else and we don't separate you. You know, I think in today's society, we have to put everybody in these categories. And I think for me, that was really the lesson of how special the two-spirit identity and movement is. So it's, you know, in the LGBT community, we talk a lot about coming out. But with two-spirit, I think the emphasis isn't so much about coming out as it is more about coming home.
Oh, that's powerful. Thank you so much, Carl.
Yes, of course.
And Carl Colgrove is a member of the Hoopa Valley Tribe and the first Native American board member within the Sacramento LGBT Community Center, speaking to us about what two-spirit means to him. Still ahead, we head to UC Davis and we learn about a center which works to increase retention rates by creating community and place for Indigenous students. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. At UC Davis, Native American Studies is available as a minor and a major at the undergraduate level, not to mention for master's and PhD programs, including multiple ways to incorporate Native American Studies as a PhD emphasis. The campus also has centers that encourage retention rates for underrepresented groups, African American students, women, LGBTQIA, Chicano, and also for Indigenous students. We're going to learn more about the Native Nest Center on campus. Michelle Villegas-Frazier is the director of the Native American Academic Student Success Center, and Nora Zaid is a student assistant with the UC Davis Native Nest Center. Welcome both to Insight.
Welcome. Thank you for having us today.
Michelle, you're the inaugural director of this center. What led to the creation of the Native American Academic Student Success Center?
Right. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the land that UC Davis currently resides on, which is the Patwin people. So these centers, what you refer to as the Native Nest is part of four academic retention initiatives and centers that UC Davis has developed. It's more about 5 to 6 years old, depending on the center. And it's really looking at increasing graduation rates, but doing it with a cultural lens. So depending on our communities, our programming will work around developing academic support services for specific ethnic communities. So the Native Nest, we will actually be celebrating our 5-year of the center in April. So we're really excited about that. And so again, we started about five years ago.
Well, Nora, you're a student assistant at Native Nest. How did Native Nest help you personally? And especially, I mean, I think for a lot of college students and students at large, I mean, in light of the pandemic and the struggles that come with that.
Yeah, the Nest has helped me immensely. Obviously, it's very nerve-wracking coming to such a prestigious and wonderful university as UC Davis. So having this support system in this community that I know that has my back, like that helped me a lot. And it has helped my confidence as like a student, as an Indigenous person. And it really has just kind of given me the extra support that I need as somebody at UC Davis.
And you're from El Dorado County, correct? Placerville?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, can you share the tradition of beading circles? Because that still took place, right, during the pandemic over Zoom?
Yeah, it did. So with beading circles, what we all do is, I mean, at the Nest, we kind of have like a designated project that we all are kind of working on together. And that also happened over Zoom over the pandemic. And it was great because you kind of just had a way to relax and to like culturally connect with a craft and to kind of just connect with your community in a way that you couldn't in person at the time. And it was a really like helpful way to connect with other Indigenous students and just a nice way to kind of take your mind off of the pandemic for a little bit and be able to share community with other people.
Right. It's like a social and also a healing time.
Yes, for sure.
Michelle, you know, the center really creates a community and place for Indigenous students. How many Indigenous students are there within the campus? Because UC Davis is, it's like a city, you know, there's tens of thousands of students.
Right. So, and it's complicated and complex because Native folks and Indigenous folks hold different identities. So currently we have a little over about 570 self-identified Native and Indigenous folks here on campus.
And I mean, just hearing that, I would think that that really hits home the importance of having a center and a place like this, because it makes it easier for students like Nora to connect with classmates and have these wonderful moments such as beading circles.
Right. So a couple of times we refer to our center as the Native Nest. And so when we developed the center, we really wanted to create a home away from home for our students, or a place to connect, a spot The university is huge, and there's so many resources that are available to students. This center actually kind of brings all those resources together, kind of like a home away from home and a one-stop shop for our students. As a Native or Indigenous person on campus, you can get overwhelmed, and sometimes you don't see anybody that looks like you or has the same background. And so there could be days that you don't see students or connect with students. So the center, and so when we developed the center, I wanted it to be you'll see the hummingbird as our graphic element. And so I wanted that nest feeling. And so everything around is about a hummingbird and that nest and a home. And so the Native nest has really created a space for students to connect and be who they are, right? Because like I said, there's about 570 plus students, and we want to support students where they're at in their development and in their identity.
Nora, I see you nodding along.
Yeah, I just really resonate with the thought that the nest is a home away from home. That's one of the major reasons that I chose UC Davis as a school, because of the center. Like, it really does feel like I have a family here, even if I'm not at home with my quote unquote real family. This is my family here. And I just really grateful that a center like this exists and allows me to have these connections with other students.
Well, on that note, what are you studying, and what does the future hold for you? What do you want to do with your degree?
Yeah, I'm currently a psychology and Native American studies double major. And after this, I hope to continue on to grad school as like a Native American studies master's program, or eventually my PhD. I hope to stay at UC Davis for these programs. And then afterwards, I want to work with K-12 Indigenous students and provide them with educational and cultural resources in order to get them to higher education, or whatever their version of success might be to them. Because I think that those resources are very important in helping students realize both their professional identity, their educational identity, and their cultural identity.
How did your experience as a youth like lead to this realization and this passion for wanting to help future K-12 Indigenous youth with these educational and cultural resources?
Yeah, so I came from a single mother like home, so her emphasis was always very important, like for education and culture, so that really kind of shaped who I am as a person, because like my background is, my father is incarcerated, so I could have gone on a very different path, but education and culture has always kept me grounded and has always kept me focused on what I want to do in my life. So if like education has worked for me, I hope that it's going to work for other Indigenous people and help revitalize our culture and continue on to create better communities.
Mm. You know, Michelle, you started with this, and I just want to expand on it, that UC Davis became really more sensitive to the fact that the campus is on Native land. How important is this?
Well, I think it's a first step in recognizing and respecting the Native folks here in California and beyond. I think it's, so we do have a land acknowledgement statement. And again, it's a baby step in terms of where we should be going. And it's moving forward from that and using that as a catalyst to really recognizing our tribal communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you also explain, I think some people may be looking at Indigenous Peoples Day and wanting to understand the distinction between Native American and Indigenous people.
Right. So today we're all celebrating or recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day. And at Davis tomorrow, we'll actually be hosting a community circle where we will be, students, staff, and faculty will be joining to just recognize the various different issues that are happening in Native community, whether it's MMIW,
and that's the boarding school. Missing and murdered Indigenous women.
Women and men, and border schools, the boarding school issue, the impact of COVID on our communities. And we just had some tribal elders pass away recently. So we'll be having this community circle to come together as a community to just heal and be in community.
Hmm. Well, that sounds wonderful, and it sounds powerful.
We're excited about it. Again, it's the Native Nest, and here at UC Davis, it's not just about the center, but it's one place of many across campus. Like you had talked about, we have Native American Studies on campus that supports our students. So the Native Nest is part of a group of communities that support our Native folks here.
Mm-hmm. Michelle and Nora, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
You.
Michelle Villegas-Frazier is the inaugural director of the Native American Academic Student Success Center at UC Davis, and Nora Zaid is a student and a student assistant with the UC Davis Native Nest Center. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. The music we've been listening to throughout the hour is Grammy Award-winning artist Mary Youngblood. We're going to close our music today with Mary Youngblood's song, My Gypsy Soul. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Pauline Bartolone, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.